The Book Nook on WYSO is presented by the Greene County Public Library with additional support from Clark County Public Library, Dayton Metro Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, and Wright Memorial Public Library.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. It's my pleasure to welcome to our studio today, Joe Garden. He's driven here all the way from Wisconsin. Welcome to the program, Joe.
Hey, Vic. Thanks for having me.
Joe, before we get started, I want to tell our listeners just what an unusual event this is because we met in a very strange way, didn't we?
We did. We met via eBay, which is, I don't know, it's now the new hot friendship app that everybody's downloading.
Actually, it was bizarre to me because you sent me a message through eBay and you said, you were selling this record album a while back and I was wondering if you still had it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, who is this guy? This guy actually kept track of a record I was selling months ago and now he's contacting me. And we ended up getting that record into your hands.
For a very reasonable price. I'd like to point out, if you're looking to purchase a record from Vic, he's an A. I would rate him at an A plus seller, or even an A plus 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 seller.
Okay, thank you for that.
You're very welcome.
But then we had a little conversation on eBay messages, and I can't remember exactly how it came up, but we were talking very unprofessionally. We're not supposed to do this on eBay about our own personal experiences in the world, and you mentioned that you had written some books, and I said, that is so cool. Let's check these books out. And here we are, and you've got a couple of them here. Let's talk about your books.
Okay. Well, I'll start. I'll give a little background information on myself as well. I was at The Onion from 1993 to 2012. I started when they were in Madison before they were online, and you know, left when they were about ready to move back to the Midwest for, you know, a number of reasons. We won't get too far into the reasons why, but I just wanted to stay in New York, and so I did. When the book The Secret came out, the Rhonda Byrne, sort of new thought magic book came out, I saw a segment on it, and I was like, this is insanely stupid, and I can't believe this is so popular. And so I called all my friends, like my Onion friends together at the time. That included my ex-wife, now ex-wife, Anita Sarwacki, who is she works at Google, Chris Pauls, who is an editor at Cracked, Janet Ginsburg, who is a producer, and, you know, she does a lot of reality show production now in Los Angeles, and Scott Sherman, who at the time, all these people, by the way, worked with me at The Onion, and they were like, I was editing their stuff as the features editor. And they, so I was like, we got to do a parody of this secret book. And so we, you know, got together and we contacted an agent. I went to my agent. They're like, well, we don't really, you know, anyway, that's too inside baseball. We submitted the proposal with some sample chapters of our secret parody. And everybody came back with the same response, which is nobody buys parodies of self-help books. And I'm like, that, you know what? That makes sense. I'm not going to argue with that. It was really funny, but it doesn't matter. So, you know, fast forward a couple months later, and the Onion's agent reached out to me. He's like, are you still, you know, interested in doing a parody book? And I'm like, well, I don't know if I'm interested in one. He's like, what do you know about The Dangerous Book for Boys? I'm like, nothing. So he gave me a rundown. And then he's like, what do you think about one of the agents here had an idea, and that is The Dangerous Book for Dogs. I'm like, I can do that. And so we reassembled the same team, got together, and The Dangerous Book for Dogs was the first of the three books we wrote together as Action 5. And we wrote a proposal. We each wrote a sample chapter. We swapped it back and forth. We edited, gave each other notes, did a second pass of it, submitted it, with illustrations from Emily Flake, who illustrated the first two books. Emily Flake, by the way, is a New Yorker cartoonist, and she's written a couple books herself, including one that's sadly out of print, These Things Ain't Gonna Smoke Themselves, about her relationship with smoking. Mama Tried, which is one about her parenting, and her new one is about hugs and awkward hugs. So anyway, but she's also super talented, very funny. I'm really glad we, you know, and it helped us bond as friends to work with her on this. So we, you know, we submitted this. We landed at Villard. He loved it. He's like, can you do this in 5 weeks? I'm like, absolutely. And so I would just like to say about this, usually when somebody says, I don't remember anything about, you know, when people talk about, like Stephen King talks about writing Cujo, he's like, I have no memory of writing that. I wish I was drunk or high all the time when I was writing The Dangerous Book for Dogs, because then I'd at least have a reason. But as it was just so, we just wrote it so quickly, and we were just like, it was such an intense process that I just like blanked it out. We weren't, you know, it was just five very intense weeks. And, you know, it seems silly to say about a novelty parody book or a satire, but it really was, you know, I honestly, I'm not going to say this is great literature, but it is a really, you know, they are very good quality books. I'm very proud of what we did. And yeah, so then we did The Dangerous Book for Dogs for the follow-up. Of course, they're like, we love it. It's been selling well. What do you got for us? And so we said, well, there's the devious or the daring book for girls, so we can do a cat book. And then they're like, great. So we did The Devious Book for Cats with Emily again. And then for the last one, we weren't sure what we were going to, like, we pitched a couple things, and finally we landed on The New Vampire's Handbook, a guide to the for the newly undead. And it was, you know, which seems like it would be, again, I'm proud of that book too, because, like, it was very, you know, we did a lot of research into it, and we tried to add some weird little twists in there, such as, you know, we tried to kind of treated it like a multi-level marketing scheme. Like, vampirism is a multi-level marketing scheme. Like, at the top, you had the author, Miles Proctor, and he was trying to hawk his products, like tube socks and so on. And the reason he needed tube socks, we incorporated that into the book, is that vampires excrete through their feet, and so you have to change your tube socks all the time. It's silly, but it's also, you know, we also were very reverent. We mostly reverent with a little bit of silliness thrown in there. And, you know, it's stood up as well. It's funny because I talked to a couple years ago, we did a little Onion reunion show in Chicago, and Tom Sharpling was a moderator for the panel. Tom Sharpling, who is the host of The Best Show, on formerly The Best Show on WFMU, now The Best Show, and, you know, he also wrote a memoir recently. He was working at the time on the first season of What We Do in the Shadows, and he's like, you know, I got this book, and I didn't know you had written it, and it was really helpful for doing research. So that was great. You know, it's, you know, as somebody who admires Tom Sharpling and his work, it was high praise indeed. So yeah, so that's those. And then we just, after those three books, we just never could come up with another idea that they were really. I think we kind of burned ourselves out as well, because these were kind of intensive, even though they're silly. Novelty parody books, they're also very intensive to write as a group. And so we just kind of like burned ourselves out. And, you know, that was the end of Action 5, so to speak. But what a legacy.
Joe Garden joins us in studio. And we're talking about some of his literary endeavors.
That was a really long monologue. I apologize for that. That was I hope that's okay.
You held their interest, Joe. That's all that matters. And these listeners out there, some of them are dog people, some of them are cat people, some of them are neither, some of them are both. Can you give us some like slight examples of what you mean by devious cats and dangerous dogs?
Well, I'll read a little bit from the introduction to The Dangerous Book for Dogs, because I think that's the best way. Preface: I didn't have this book when I was a puppy. There was a time not long ago when dogs were necessities, not accessories. We corralled wayward sheep in the heartland. We brought warming brandy to climbers in the hinterland. We were a valued asset to every fireman, a faithful sentinel for every junk man, and a slavishly loyal friend to the everyman. We roamed freely because we had earned our keep, and our aggressions under wanderlust were celebrated, not leashed. It was a time when we ran on the ground instead of being toted about in frilly pink satchels. A time when we were simply hosed down in the backyard instead of ferried to the groomer. It was a time, BD, before domestication, when we could be what we are. Dogs. You know, so it's just the idea. It's, you know, as a takeoff on the Dangerous Book for Boys, just in that same vein, like getting back to the roots of, you know, dogs getting back to their roots, which included, you know, rolling in poop or smelly things you can roll in, you know, horrible things you can eat. And then what else? You know, how to ruin the perfect dinner party, bath time. There's a little chapter on Pavlov, how the dogs conditioned Pavlov to ring a bell, and so on and so forth. It's, you know, it's in that vein. And so it's a fun, I mean, it's, yeah.
That's very good, since you don't remember even writing the book. But, you know, that's very good. So let's do the cats, because I'm a cat guy, and I need to hear a little bit about cats.
I'm also a cat guy. Okay. I'm a cat and dog guy. Okay. We have three cats at our house. We have Junior Samples Jr., Carl's the third, and Gloria, who doesn't have any additional names.
Mm-hmm.
Gloria is still a pretty good name. Actually, Gloria is a great name. If I say pretty good name, it sounds like I'm slighting her, but I'm just trying to be modest about it.
Pretty good.
yeah, so there's like it's funny because I think the cat book, there's a number of references that are might not seem in place in the cat book, such as, you know, there's at least one, you know, there's a chapter that's sort of a reefer, an entire reefer madness, reference, mm-hmm. Because we talk about catnip and the dangers and perils of catnip. There's an Invasion of the Body Snatchers, the 1950s version, reference in a chapter about vacuum cleaners. And, you know, there's also there's a little Star Trek reference in there. There's an entire chapter called The Window, which is sort of like a TV guide listing, a chapter made up to look like a TV guide listing. Because you have three options. Every good house has three options. You have the front window, the side window, and the back window. And you can watch, you know, choose which window you want to watch. And one of them, you know, you can watch the squirrels frolic around. You can watch the newspaper boy get into an argument with his neighbor. And the Star Trek references there is like, you can go to the Star Trek, you can go to the side window at 7 o'clock at night and watch your next door neighbor watch Star Trek through their window. And it's, unfortunately, it's just the episode where Spock is a hippie again. So. You know, it's
yeah.
It's very. It's funny because, like, I don't know how well this translates. You know, for me to talk about it, it's probably available on Amazon for like 5 cents. So you know, go pick yourself up a copy. It's fine.
Now, the books are still in print, right?
They are still in print. Yeah. It's kind of astonishing. You know, yeah. I keep on waiting for that. Have you ever heard the poem "My Enemy's Book Has Been Remaindered"?
No, but it sounds like a great poem.
It is a great poem. You mm-hmm. kind of get the gist of it right from the title.
Yeah.
But yeah, I keep on waiting for that phone call or the email from our agents to say, "Oh, your book. You know, if you want to get any extra copies of your book, now's the time because they're going to mm-hmm. send them all to the shredder. So you know, if you want to buy them, this is it." But you know, it's been in print for 10 years now, and it hasn't been, you know, it hasn't been taken out. So,
and each year you get your little royalty check?
Very little.
Uh-huh. What's a typical amount that you would get?
Well, this last royalty check was about $5.
Uh-huh.
To be fair, the advance was high, and you know, so we're still earning out. Yeah, we're still earning out.
Okay.
So,
right.
But it's a you know, and then the vampire. It's funny because like we released the vampire book, unfortunately. I think that actually stands the test of time because that was also in the midst of the vampire craze of the like late aughts, early teens, and you know, there was just a glut. And I think if we had, you know,
Anne Rice and all that.
This is more the Twilight time.
Okay.
And that's my only reason. That's the only reason I have familiarity with the Twilight, any of the Twilight books, is because I was like, well, gotta watch this for research, and so.
Yeah, I have never interviewed her. I think she's too famous now.
I think, Well, I don't know. I mean, maybe. That was 10 years ago. You know, she might be readily available at this point because she hasn't written anything since, except for she wrote a she started telling the Twilight Saga again through Edwards. That was the last thing I had heard. But.
Well, when they start doing the Twilight cookbooks, that's when you know.
Unfortunately, we never rose to that level of fame. We never rose to the Dangerous Book for Cats cookbook level of fame.
Okay.
But we, not for lack of trying, you know. Right. I'm still, hey, if any publishers are out there interested in the new Vampires Vampires Handbook cookbook, we're here for you.
It's the Book Nook on WYSO, and if you've been tuning in here during this last 15 minutes, you probably noticed that WYSO Weekend isn't on right now because they're taking the week off this week. We have a special extended Book Nook for you instead, and we'll bring you the Book Nook right up until 11 o'clock, and I'll continue my conversation with Joe Garden right after this. In case you're just tuning in, it's the Book Nook on WYSO, your source for public service journalism music discovery. I'm Vic McCunis. I've been joined in studio by Joe Garden. Joe, I mentioned to someone yesterday, I said, I've got someone coming in all the way from Madison, Wisconsin for an in-studio interview. And this guy used to work for The Onion. And she said, what's The Onion? So we probably have a few listeners out there. You mentioned The Onion, and there's some listeners out there who are like, what's he talking about? He's in the produce department? I mean, what is The Onion?
Well, it's funny. The Onion, it went from there's a bell curve of recognition with The Onion, because now everything is shared through Facebook and through social media. But at the time, back in the late 90s, early 2000s, The Onion was it is still its own website, but it's a satirical news website, sort of in the vein of, The Daily Show, except for it's satirizing print media instead of news media. And, it got its start in 1988 and by two gentlemen in Madison, Tim Keck and Chris Johnson. Tim Keck went on to start The Stranger, a free weekly in Seattle, and Chris Johnson went on to start the New City in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And the people who wrote for The Onion, I had my specialty was sort of character pieces. I had two recurring characters. One was a Hollywood gossip columnist who wrote a column called The Outside Scoop with Jackie Harvey. And the other one was a sort of a stoner Hesher character named Jim Anschauer, who would, basically every installment included some version of his car breaking down and, drinking Miller beer. Based on a lot of people, they were both composites of people I knew. It was very popular, and it still is very popular. You still see a lot of stuff that they share, One of the things they did for about 5 years was every time they had a mass shooting, they would rerun the same issue, the same article, but with just the name of the city involved. And it's like nothing we can do about it says only nation in world where this happens regularly. And they would just like run that. And, so more in that case, less laugh out loud funny and more wry commentary, but it's not to say that there was not actual funny stuff in there. I mean, and the people have gone on to do, people from The Onion have gone on to do a lot of other, amazing stuff. Megan Gans is one of the alumni. She does a show for Apple Plus called Mythic Quest, and she wrote on Community. Dan Guterman wrote on Community and also writes on, he wrote on Rick and Morty. Who else am I thinking of right now? Oh, Carol Kolb writes for Brooklyn Nine-Nine and wrote for Community and wrote for a bunch of other stuff. Rob Siegel, who was the editor, he's directed a couple movies, including the first movie he did, I have a small role in. It's called Big Fan, starring Patton Oswalt, and I play his brother-in-law, who works at a Costco-like store, and it was not a very hard role for me to embrace because I have a slavish love of Costco, and it was very easy to channel that sort of enthusiasm. In fact, it's also funny, they also shot some of it at my apartment at the time in Brooklyn, and Kevin Corrigan is also in the film, and he was in our bed, you know, in the bed and being shot. And I was just like, we washed the sheets for you. And he's like, I appreciate it. And it was very, yeah. And so, but, you know, Rob has written other, he wrote The Wrestler, the Darren Aronofsky film. And, you know, there's a lot of people who've like, you know, it's funny because several people have been like, oh, there should be a book about The Onion. I was like, well, maybe. But the problem with that is that there's not really a, you know, it doesn't have the same sort of dramatic arc that, say something like Saturday Night Live did, where mm-hmm. the people broke out and became superstars. If people broke out and became behind-the-scenes people. Or, you know, The National Lampoon, where there was no Onion franchise, like movie franchises. There was an Onion movie. I don't recommend it. It's just called The Onion Movie. It's not very good. So let me just, you know, I could talk about that for hours, but I also was not as involved, so I'm just going to leave that there. I'm just going to leave that there.
I didn't even know there was an Onion movie.
It never made theaters. It was direct to DVD. Originally, it was going to be – it was a sketch comedy movie, and – we weren't really sketch comedy people, and we didn't, you know, the way we wrote it was a little bit, we wrote it the same way we wrote the paper, and I think that was part of the issue. Like, we didn't really, you know, we didn't workshop it, we didn't, and there's still some funny ideas, and there's still some funny sketches in there, but I think it was just a little bit clunkier. And then, you know, a lot of people were involved that if we had done it ourselves, I think we could have done a much better, you know, a much better job, but...
So you were involved with the movie?
I was semi-quasi involved with the movie. I wrote some sketches that didn't make it. I can be seen in the background of one scene, in the far, far background of one scene. I have to look for myself really closely, but I also haven't watched it in 10 years, so.
Sort of an Alfred Hitchcock cameo.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I did make Alfred Hitchcock's trademark scowl the entire time. I remember. Good evening. There's the Onion.
Okay.
I think I have one of the only existing it was only a DVD release or direct to DVD release, and so they had DVD posters that I was able to find one on eBay, and there I go back to eBay again. Found one on eBay, and it's signed by Rob Siegel and Todd Hansen, who was the head writer and one of the two writers at the time. And I think I have the only signed Onion movie poster in existence right now. So I'm waiting for my opportunity. You know, it's funny. The other thing about that is, like, you know, you watch that and there's people, you know, the smaller bit parts in that were played by people like Paul Scheer, who, you know, went on to be part of Human Giant and, with Aziz Ansari. Aziz Ansari was an intern at The Onion way back in the day. The story of The Onion, actually, I'd like to go back and amend something. The story of The Onion is like the people who were, you know, contributors and interns wound up, they wound up blowing up. They eclipsed, the stuff they did eclipsed everything The Onion did. Like Aziz Ansari was an intern. Ellie Kemper was a contributing writer for several years. Who else? Rachel Bloom, who created My Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, she worked for the Onion News Network as an intern staffer. It's interesting. It's very, I think at one point I was in the subway in Brooklyn with Todd Hansen, the former head writer, and on one, the subway is just loaded with, you know, billboard or subway posters all down the line. And on one poster, on the poster to my right was one for Master of None with Aziz Ansari. On the poster to my left was Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt with Ellie Kemper. And so I just posed looking sad in the middle of them. I was just like, whoa is me. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. They made it.
Oh, good
and
for
here,
that.
Well, and here I am standing in the subway.
Well, they deserve it. I mean, they're definitely they're both more talented than I am. Okay. So,
well, you keep mentioning posters, and I kind of got the impression from looking at your eBay site that you're a poster collector.
I am a poster collector. Uh-huh. And I have, you know, it's hard because, like, I don't want to be one of the kind of people that has posters that are just, like, sitting in a flat file. I like to have them out. But, mm-hmm. you know, I you know, it's a kind of, and right, especially movie posters, which are sort of a dying art now that they have the, you know, the flat, the equivalent of a flat screen TV that just sort of changes the poster every, you know, 30 seconds. But I, you know, I also have, you know, I like sort of like the pop art posters from the 60s and 70s. Mm-hmm. There's, you know, I have a lot of, I was lucky enough to buy, I also do a lot of secondhand dealing. I would say vintage, but I have a whole angry screed about the word vintage that I won't, I'll get into momentarily.
You're talking about like the French posters from the 1890s, that kind of thing?
I wish I had. I mean, those are like go for a little bit more money than I'm willing to spend on it, and it's like that would be something I need to like have a nice frame. But I keep an eye out for stuff like that. You know, I have like some old War Bonds posters, old like, you know. I bought a stack of posters from the estate of Betty and Ian Ballantyne, who ran Ballantyne Books and also ran Bantam publications for a while. And they had an imprint called the Bantam Galleries, where they would sort of release posters of their of some of their science fiction and fantasy titles. So stuff like Wizard of Earthsea and you know. Who else? Like Leo and Diane Dillon posters, and they were like, you know, really just all these like really kind of very like posters that were like really made an imprint on me when I was a kid, and it was fun to have the posters of those. Oh, and like Brian Froud as well, a lot of those posters. So yeah, I mean, and I just like, I mean, I really do like, you know, it's, but again, it's hard because it's like, it's hard to, you know, it's a lot of money to frame posters, and so it's like it's fun to collect them, but it's also fun to like have them for a little while and then sort of move them on. Mm-hmm. Like that's, you know, that's kind of the thing I really enjoy about like doing what I do right now, which is like the secondhand selling. So I love stuff, but I also realize that I have an unhealthy relationship with stuff. So it's nice to be able to enjoy, like have something, enjoy it, appreciate it, and then just move it on.
Mm-hmm. I am not a poster collector. I have posters, but I've been hitting myself for many years because back in Des Moines, my dad worked in an insurance company, and the man who was his boss died probably 30-some years ago. Mm-hmm. And I went to an estate sale at his house, and we went up into the attic, and he had these clotheslines hanging up, and there were hundreds of World War I posters.
Oh, wow.
In beautiful condition that he apparently had collected as a kid, and hundreds of them reasonably priced. And I'm like, well, what would I want that for? and to this day, I just really regret not getting one of those posters.
Yeah.
And I always wonder, well, what happened to them?
Well, yeah, it's also, you know, they probably went to, well, there's a pretty famous gallery auctioneer called the auction house called the Swan Galleries in New York. They might have some of them at this point because, you know, posters move around from collector to collector just like any, you know, smaller antique does. It's I really like the sort of the wartime propaganda posters, like World War I and World War II posters. You know, those are really, they're beautiful. And I also like the sort of bluntness of the message. And, you know, it also feels like that's, you know, it's almost kind of like a dead, and it's like a dead medium at this point because you don't, you know, where would, I don't, I'm not, as somebody who is clearly too young to have served and lived through World War II, I have no idea where you would have actually put these up if they would have been in like store windows or what have you. But, I don't think that that's, I mean, maybe we could be a lot, who knows, maybe a good poster program is all we need to get more people vaccinated in this country at this point. Not actually, but I'm not that naive.
Well, I follow you on Twitter, as you know, and I saw that you posted some photos recently. It looked like you were in front of some grand house in maybe New York somewhere.
Yeah.
What were you up to?
In Brooklyn, I was working with an auctioneer who was it is an interesting house. I'd helped him with some other stuff. I'd gone down there like three or four other times, and we were just clearing stuff out of the house and helping the woman who lived there. We were helping her. You know, she wanted to sell everything, and she wanted to get a smaller apartment, and she wanted to sell this building. And it was a pretty decrepit. It was the it was kind of like it looked like a haunted mansion. I did not see any ghosts in my time there, sadly, or fortunately. I don't know what I would actually do if I saw a ghost. But it was so I was there to help with that. We had in earlier trips we had gotten to clear all this, like we went through the backyard and just sort of like pulled away all these vines and like stacked up fencing, and there was a a cemetery fence back there that sold for like $32,000. $23,000. I don't want to transcribe. It wasn't my, unfortunately, it wasn't, none of that money was mine. But
a
I think
cemetery fence?
Cemetery fencing, yeah. It's just
now,
like,
what is that, metal?
No, it is metal. It's like a cast iron fence that is, has like a sort of a pastoral scene. In this case, it was like every section of fencing had like a circular inset with willow trees and sheep. Uh-huh. And it was really beautiful. There's also like the fencing from the Coney Island steeplechase, the old like horse racetrack that used to be in Coney Island. All the fencing from there was in the back, and even if you didn't have any love of the actual provenance of it, I think that only sold for like $2,000. That's a good deal on cast iron fencing. Mm. I know that's the thing. It's like you don't realize until you, that's kind of what I like. Is like I get to see and interact with all these pieces from history, and it's just such it's kind of humbling, and it's really kind of you just get to hold something or touch something that had like a you're like, what was this used for? How was this how old is it? What's the history that led it to here? Mm. And, that's what I really love about that. So,
well, we could talk for hours. I know you need to hit the road again. We really appreciate you stopping in to see us.
Well, thank you very much.
My guest has been Joe Garden, and we've been talking about his various endeavors and works, including The Dangerous Book for Dogs, written by Rex and Sparky, and The Devious Book for Cats, written by Fluffy and...
Bonkers.
Bonkers, yeah. So if you're looking for the author name on that, you might want to look for Fluffy here.
Or the vampire book is The New Vampire's Handbook by the vampire Miles Proctor.
Very good. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Vic.
You're listening to The Book Nook on WYSO. And if you just tuned in, you heard the tail end of my interview with Joe Garden. And you might have been wondering, if you're accustomed to tuning in for The Book Nook at 10:30, why we started the show early. Well, WYSO Weekend took the week off. And so we had an extended program today. We began it a half hour early, and we'll continue it with a special Book Nook bonus segment coming up right after our break. And this bonus segment was recorded back in 1999, and a really fascinating book, a first book by a very mysterious author, a very scary book, and a very odd man who wrote it. I know nothing about him now. I knew nothing about him then except what he was willing to tell us. And that's coming up right after this. The Book Nook continues on WYSO with a special Book Nook bonus segment. Back in 1999, I discovered a novel by an author named Boston Turan. It was his first book. It was called God is a Bullet. And I read the book, and I was so haunted by it, I had to get an interview with him, and I did. And it stuck with me. 22 years later, I am still haunted by this scary book. And Boston Turan is a mysterious guy, and I think you'll agree with me when you listen to him as he talked about God is a Bullet back in 1999 on WYSO.
Originally, I had been traveling around the desert, Mojave, and into Mexico, looking for, sketching ideas and looking for a story for a book. And through some people I knew, they said, we'd like to introduce you to a gentleman who lives out in the desert. He used to be in the Army. He is now, quote-unquote, retired. He's had a varied and interesting background, and maybe you'd like to meet with him. And I said, sure. And I went out to the desert, and we met. And this man had done all kinds of of odd things, and he was still in the business of getting people new IDs, and if you had a problem of some kind, he would either find a way to solve it or find somebody who knew how to take care of it. And we got to be friendly over time. Eventually, he actually became a character in the book known as the Ferryman. And he said to me after a couple of months, he said, listen, I have to go down into Mexico. He said, there's a kid that used to run around with a satanic cult in the United States. And he wanted to bust with them, and he stole a bunch of money from them so he could start over again. And he went and he's hiding in Mexico. He needs me to go down there and bring him out of Mexico and get him a new ID and start a new life. He said, how would you like to take the trip down with me? And I said, sure. Sounds fraught with possibilities. And the kid was about 600 miles south of the border, so we had to take a van down there. He had a broken leg at the time. And the guy was also being slightly selfish. He said, listen, you know, the kid's got a busted leg, so I need somebody to help me with the driving and also long trip back. So we took the trip back, and on the way back, you know, it began to be very interesting because we were traveling at night, and the kid was absolutely paranoid that, you know, these people that he'd ripped off would eventually come back to get him. And if you know Mexico and you're way in the back hills there, it is not like being in the rural United States. When you see headlights coming, you could be in trouble.
Hmm.
And so that level of kind of intense level of fear, which he felt, when I saw that, I sort of knew at that point that there was possibilities there for a story and for a book.
Now, the ferryman, is he really similar to the guy in the book? The guy in the book is pretty unusual.
He is similar in his background, but he is different in his physicality.
You really take the reader into the center of darkness with this one. You grew up in the South Bronx. We think of the South Bronx as being kind of a tough place. What was your upbringing like?
There's the old joke that I grew up in New York when it was safe to carry a gun. So it was a tough environment. Everybody carried in those days homemade guns, zip guns, and we moved around in our own world and lived our life accordingly. It's interesting because the book is qualified as, it's been a fascinating discovery on this because the book is called a thriller, yet it's been called actually just a book of fiction. It's been called, then somebody emailed from some chat group and said, oh, it's not a book of fiction, it's not a thriller, it's a horror book, because it could never be a thriller because the subject matter is too horrific. And then Canopsa, they bought the book because it was a book of fiction. It seems to cross a lot of boundaries, and I think because of the powerful moral identities that it brings out in people about the lead characters and who they are and what this journey is for them to go through to reach a successful conclusion of their lives.
Well, I have my own idea. I think it's a romance.
Well, certainly you could qualify it in many ways as a romance, because it is a romance between, and for the audience who doesn't know the story at all, the two central characters of the book are a small-town Christian policeman who is trying to get back his kidnapped daughter, and he comes with all the classic American values. He's everything we have come to respect as ideas, and he is confronted with a woman who is the heroine of the book, who was an ex-satanic cult member, an ex-heroin addict, had been a child prostitute, has lived every atrocity, and is a classic atheist. And it is she who must lead him into this satanic underground to get the man's daughter back. And with that, they must begin to, with the two of them have to ally together, they must begin to confront the two worlds that they have so much believed in, and they must evolve to some other place. They must form some third bond in order to successfully achieve what they need to do.
Boston Turan has joined us. His new book is God is a Bullet. Boston, I get the impression that the publisher over at Knopf really took you under his wing.
Yeah, I mean, Sonny Mehta, when he read the book, he said, "I'm buying this book for two reasons." He said, "The second reason is it's one of the greatest and scariest books I've ever read in my whole life." He said, "But first and foremost, it's a classic morality tale. I mean, it rides both lines. It's what people, I gather, you know." He said, "People used to try to do this in fiction, to write popular fiction that at the same time had literary value, and it's a thin and difficult line to sort of weather." And I think that's what got them wholly involved in the book.
Now, looking at the book as a reader, especially a first book, we're always hungry to know about the author. We want to know what you look like. We want to know a little bit about your history. And looking at this book, you are pretty anonymous. I get the feeling that anonymity is something that you're accustomed to.
Well, you're partly accustomed to, but as in all things, a book like this could never be had through celebrity. It would become too difficult and impossible a journey. You can't get these kinds of books. That is one aspect. But there's a second one, and you know, Keats had a concept, you know, the concept of, you know, negative capability. The author should be able to void him or herself out and become what they write about. We seem to have in this country a desire to attach so much to the author about how tall are they. It's the old Shakespeare story. You know, if Shakespeare were the Edward, you know, the Earl of Oxford, he would have been gay, so all those poems would have been gay poems. And if he's actually Shakespeare, we've got to find out who the woman is. They're trying to build so much around the person in ways to describe and define the book. I'm trying to separate from all that, because somewhere down the road, if you want to write about a completely other subject from an other point of view, you want to have the freedom of that, where people are not starting to attach and will say, well, you know, he's actually a tall Christian man, so we can't write about short non-Christian women. And you know, it would have been best if I could have even taken a step back and just had, you know, J. Smith, and then to, you know, unfortunately, I have to say he was born in the Bronx or she was born in the Bronx, so it breaks it down, because then we start to it becomes a limiting posture, and it also becomes a fixture of celebrityhood. I have, and I use the term celebrityhood in the broadest sense. I have always said I don't go on television, and I don't go on the road, and I'm not trying to become a face. If the books can't hold their ground, if they can't do what they need to do as books, then I have failed, and I need to move on and do something else. If they need me to be the dance hall queen to drive it, then I'm not doing my job.
Well, we're definitely not here to dissect you. There's plenty of dissection in the book, actually, and I mean that in a humorous way. I'm trying. Boston, reading the book, we get so attached to these characters. They are so fully drawn, particularly your two protagonist characters. You really relate to them. You really understand them. And you see this Christian policeman become one with the beast in the book. And you understand. And it really takes the reader into this world of violence where you get it. You understand why violence would be necessary, even if you're a very peaceful person. You really change him and you change the reader.
I think because we put a human face to it, because, you know, people said to me, you know, why did it, you know, you wrote a violent book, and I said, I certainly didn't mean to write a violent book, but I said the subject matter, you know, I researched was violent. The world I was trying to put down on paper sort of demands that honesty, it demands truth. You know, to make violence fun is in many times a fraud. It's as if it's all right. It's a game. It's no game, and it has an effect on our human soul and our human consciousness. And to take people into that is to make those people pitiable. To make them you be able to feel inside them. I mean, that's what books have always done so beautifully through time, is to make you feel. That's what people really want. You know, it's been an amazing exercise for me because as I went through this, I get a huge amount of email. I have a website off the book, and since the book has come out, I am flooded with emails from all over the country and from all different kinds of people, from all different kinds of walks of life. And they approach the book and their feelings about it in a far different way than you ever see reviewers do or critics do. I put a couple of pages together because it's just been a fascinating. Because to me, it's always revelatory as I sit there, and I'd like to read a couple to you because they're rather amazing.
Great.
There's one that says, "I just finished your book last night and I was riveted. The world you described is foreign to me, a children's librarian. And my eyes were on stalks as I followed Bob and Case through those 300 pages. It was an eye-opening experience. And in light of Columbine, it is time we face the fact there is evil in the world of our youth, whether they have a Cyrus to direct them or not." And then I have another one from my high school kid who said, and I don't know if this is a boy or a girl, actually. He says, "I was reading God is a Bullet when the murders of Littleton happened, and I was blown away by the coincidence. How right Bullet was with its reality of evil. Your novel makes sense out of the world I was watching on television. Everyone at school is freaked. I told my teacher to read Bullet for the truth about violence. It gets into who is really Christian and who is satanic. It's the catechism for all things adults don't want to look at, much less discuss. If that's too weird a thought, I'm sorry, but that's how I feel." Those are just two. So,
Boston Turan has joined us. His book is God is a Bullet. We are learning a little bit about you. We know your voice now, and if you read the book, I think we discover that you probably really liked to listen to the radio back in the 60s.
I still do.
Can really tell your cult members in particular like to spout song lyrics, particularly Bob Dylan. I never had the impact of Bob Dylan quite as much until I read it coming out of their voices.
I think very clearly, you know, there's two classic types of poetry in America today. There is the true poetry of the written word, and there's also the popular poetry that runs through all kinds of music and in all kinds of facets for all kinds of subcultures in this country. And I think it's very much part of the human experience. I mean, people relate to that, even if you don't know the lyrics many times. When you hear the words in relationship to what people are thinking, either through counterpoint or irony or drama or just through sexuality, you get a very clear look at who they are. And I think we have all been there because I think we've all been riding down the car on some road when the music's playing and go into some either fantasy or some special spot that either brings up tremendous pain or tremendous joy.
You've been listening to a special Best of the Book Nook bonus segment, a small portion of an interview I did back in 1999 with a very mysterious guy named Boston Turan for his novel God is a Bullet. It was his debut novel. There was no author photo of him. There was no biographical information. It told you nothing about him, and that's the way he wanted it. And all these years later, I don't have a clue who he was. He did the interview on the phone, so obviously I never saw him. He had a really striking voice and was clearly a very highly intelligent person. And a scary book that has stuck with me all these years, God is a Bullet. Track it down. His only appearance on the program, recorded back in 1999, as we conclude this special hour-long Sunday edition of the Book Nook. And if you like hearing what authors have to say about their work, I would suggest, if you haven't already discovered our Book Nook podcast archive, that you check it out. Go to wyso.org and go to the Book Nook pages, where we have over 700 author interviews archived. You can listen to them at your leisure. Just go to wyso.org and click through. And James Lee Burke has a new book coming out soon, and we're going to do what was my 20th interview with James Lee Burke in coming weeks. Check out those podcasts. There's lots of Jim Burke in there. For the Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis.